Hello and welcome to another episode of Monster Dear Monster, a monster exploration podcast where we take a look at monsters from their folkloric origins to their current pop culture incarnations.
My name is Dave, and I'm joined today by Cameron. How's it going, Cameron?
Hello, I'm doing pretty all right. I'm back to work tomorrow morning, which I'm less pleased about, but for now I get to do a lovely recording.
Yeah, that was winter break.
Sort of like an autumn break. We get a couple of weeks in between terms. It's all over the place.
It's been years. Like, I know it's backwards, or not backwards, that's rude. It's the opposite. It's the opposite of our seasons in the north. So this is a bonus episode. It's a special episode.
Special episode.
And we're going to try to kick off the rest of this year with some interviews, some creator interviews. And today we have with us an author of yokai fiction and also like an encyclopedia. So this is fantastic. If you could have said something was in our wheelhouse, like, this is exactly it. So today joining us is Teresa Matsuda.
Hello. How are you?
We're doing pretty good. Well, for me, it's the spring. Terrible. I'm in Texas, so the weather is horrendous.
Oh, Texas. No.
It's not great weather. But yeah, I mean, it's not thundering rain and there's not a hurricane yet. So I guess we're doing okay.
It'll always be
hot soon.
Yeah, it'll be unbearably hot and wet. Like, just humidity is not fun here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so you have expatriated to Japan.
Yes, I have.
And so how long have you been there? Yeah, you said it was a while.
It's been a while. 1990. So
okay.
Wow. 30, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, right out of university.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. And what got you moving over there?
Let's see. Martial arts. I was really into martial arts and Buddhism at the time, all through junior high and high school. And kind of jumped around with martial arts. I was doing Chinese. I was like doing Kung Fu and Tai Chi and those with Buddhism, Tibetan. I also loved Zen. And I went to China for a tiny bit, like a month, and fell in love with the whole idea of studying overseas. Like, I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know you could actually go to another country and like live and study and have this experience.
Yeah.
So that just, but the problem was, I was also in China in a very small island, and you're walking down the street and they're like, oh, there's a dog that they're selling for dinner. Yeah. I can't do this. But I love the culture. I love a different culture. I love like Buddhism, again, martial arts. And I was going to graduate, did not know what to do. And I was walking to my counselor or whatever, guidance person, and saying, listen, you know, I got all these credits, you know, I'm ready to graduate and I have no idea what I'm going to do with my life. And there was a poster on the wall for a exchange program to the sister university of my university. And it was Japan. And I was like, hey, what's that? And they're like, oh, you should apply. And I said, okay.
Yeah.
And the rest is history. I just ended up here. Yeah. And it's perfect.
Yeah.
Because I love the Chinese characters. I really love kanji. Like that, I fell in love with that. So I get it in Japan. I was terrible at speaking and understanding Chinese because of the
tones.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh, it was so hard. And you don't have any of that in Japan, right? The Japanese is just flat and it's wonderful. So it's kind of like the perfect fit.
You just get the regional accent. Yeah.
Yes. You got to deal with that. Yes. Yeah. Go to Osaka. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. That's something that had interested me when I was in university, and I got around to it only by taking like several semesters of Japanese. And then I was like, maybe I'll do international business, and then realized math is not my forte. They want me to do a lot of math.
That was my downfall too.
Yeah. So I made my peace with that. I went into the military for a little while, but I went in as a crypto linguist.
Oh, cool.
So they basically put me through language school, and I learned. I would have liked to take Japanese, but you have to be an officer, and I was not. So instead, I learned Korean, then I had that handful of credits of all this stuff. And so when I came back, or I finished my enlistment, and I was like, I should probably go get my degree, finish that up. And I went to the university, and I was like, look, I have enough credits for you to just give me a degree, you know, what can we work out? And like, yeah, we're going to take like a quarter of that and basically just ignore the rest. But we have a Asian studies program you have to major in Chinese or Japanese. And I was like, maybe I can, but look at these, look at all these Korean credits I have. What can I do?
Like I've already worked so hard. Come on.
Yeah. And so they said, well, we don't have that program, but if you take every course we have at the university that's in Korean or that's a Korean course, we can like make a program for you. So I am the only graduate of Arizona State University with a my degree with focus in Korean.
Awesome.
like East Asian studies. So yeah, that's also eventually what led me to do this podcast because I have a lot of books on mythology and history. And I was like, I'm doing jobs that have nothing to do with my degree at all. I can't use this really. But I would like to use the primary sources and things that I have. And I love these books, and I'd like to, you know, refer to them and use them and kind of make an academic podcast. That's not what happened with the podcast.
No.
But sometimes we get, you know, I have a chance to pull a book out or something and kind of dig a little bit more into a region. But that all basically segues kind of into, so when you got into yokai and everything, I think you, maybe it was your first episode of your podcast, but you talked a little bit about not finding like English translated sources.
Yes.
Like everything was in Japanese or Chinese.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about it too, like the first time I encountered a yokai. Like, what is a yokai? Because like I said, like in 1990, that's pre-internet. This is like beyond, even now, even though I lived that time, I can't believe it was that time. But so there was no manga. I mean, Astro Boy maybe, but there was no manga. There was no anime. Japan wasn't beloved like it is now. And I came to Japan, whatever, I'm going to study Japanese. And I had no idea, no concept of what a yokai was. And I was with a friend and we were hiking around like there's five lakes at the bottom of Mount Fuji. And we were hiking around there, come across this statue, and it's I'm used to Buddhist statues. They're very pretty, they're very pristine. Yeah. You know, Bodhisattva, all these really nice. This thing was horrible. It was like dirty and it was carved in wood. It had marble eyes and it had a robe that was just shredded and torn, and it had a beak and it had a shell on its back and it had this spiky hair. My Japanese is crap back then too, but I asked my friend, you know, what is this, right? Oh, that's a kappa. A kappa? Like, what is it? Is it a god? Is it a... And they, you know, kind of explained it lives in water and it drowns you. And just mind blown, right? I'm like, I didn't even know there was more of these things. I thought this is like one of... This was it, right? There's no tengu, there's no oni. I had no idea kappa. About the other ones yet. And I go back, I ask people and they're kind of like, yeah, we know what a kappa is. But I don't know how to get the information. There's no online. The libraries, I don't even know how to use a library. And then one day, it couldn't have been too long after that, I went home to the States, came back, had jet lag. It was like 4 in the morning. I wake up there's three channels in Japan, no satellite, of course, and no cable. So I turned on the TV at 4 a.m. One's static, one's news, and the other one was Gegege no Kitaro. Again, mind blown. Like, I grab my notebook and my pen, and I'm just sitting there going, okay, Konaki, Gigi, you know, I'm writing these names down. What are these creatures, and what are they doing? And that started the love. Yeah. And then, thank God, the internet came, and I was able to do a lot more research and pick up books and stuff. So my language got better.
That's great. And it's always fun when it's like some little incident that just kicks off a passion into something.
Yeah.
Like, I think that that's something that everyone can identify with.
Absolutely. Although you've gone a bit further with your passion, seeing as you're actually publishing a book on the subject. Not everyone goes out and writes a full research piece of work.
Oh, but it took so long to do it, right?
Oh, well, take your time.
Yep. That's what it was, just collecting little bits and pieces along the way. And then,
So, what would make your book different than others on the same subject? Because there's a lot of works out there now on Yokai. So what's your personal spin on it?
That is a question I asked myself. So the acquisitions editor for Adams Media got a hold of me and said, hey, I got this idea for a book and maybe you would want to write it. And I was the same thing. I was like, there's so many good books out there. And they're... I'm not a scholar and I'm not an academic and I'm not a folklorist. I just love these stories and I collect them and I like to write fiction, little short stories about them. What could I do that was different than the other books out there? So there's two things I came up with, and it ended up, hopefully this is what worked. But the first one is the Japanese language is so, it's so easier to study now than it was back in the day. You got all these apps and these courses, right?
That's what I'm finding.
It's fantastic. I just love this. I'm jealous and I'm awed. And I'm also awed that so many of the listeners of my show are really good at Japanese. Like, I'm like, you are so good. You're listening, you're reading, you're writing, you're speaking. It's just amazing. And I find, so with, when I do my show, in the show notes, I like to put kanji. Like I said, I love kanji. I like, there's so much nuance and there's so much meaning behind them. So with the creatures or phrases or certain temples or whatever, I'll put the kanji in there so people could see it. And I don't know if anyone went to my show. Do people even look at the show notes? I never knew, but I have been getting lots of email with people saying, thank you so much, because I am studying. I'm not a beginner. I'm intermediate or advanced. And I really appreciate that. So one thing I noticed is with the books that I was reading in English is a lot of them don't have the kanji. They just have the romaji and it's in English. And you don't get the full meaning of that. Like, even a temple name, right? You say, oh, koanji. And like, there's hundreds of koanjis. But if you can actually see what the characters mean, it's like, oh, it means, you know, beautiful flowers smelling in spring or something, right? So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So I asked them, I said, like, can I put kanji in there? And they're like, sure, go ahead. So that was good. So I'm like, okay, if I can do that, that would be different. So people could actually study a little bit from it. And then the second thing I wanted to do was, again, like, there's, you know, say you have a kappa and you have the basics of a kappa. This is what a kappa is. And it's the history and what it does and all this. And you can't really change that, right? So every book's going to more or less be the same. You know, you're just getting it told by a different person. So I'm like, okay, what can I do that's different? And I do have quite a few, like a bunch of Japanese books and whatever resources that I've dug up. So I figured there's 45 chapters. They're quite, they're not long. I would love to have written twice as much about each of them. I had to cut so much, but I wanted to be really tight, the basics. Okay, this is the basics. Someone, a beginner, could come in and read this and say, oh, okay, that's what it is. But I also wanted to add like a little extra plus alpha that maybe no one has heard translated before into English. So hopefully, no matter how big or small, there's like a little something tiny in each chapter that a well-versed yokai or folklore lover would be, hey, wait a minute, I didn't know that. So I would say, okay, if I can bring those two things to the book, then okay, yeah, I'll go for it. And they were fine with both, so hopefully that works out.
It sounds really cool. I like the inclusion of the kanji, because I can listen to Japanese all right. I can't read it at all, so that's what I'm working on now.
Yeah, and it's it's just a natural part, right? Because that's how it works. You know, you can't do everything at once. And I guess the last would be speaking when you're learning a language. But yeah, that's a big thing. You don't get that. Well, I guess Korean too. It's like it's difficult. It's a thing you need to read.
Yeah, that just that getting that access and then finding things that are in your native language. So it doesn't have to be English, but whatever it's been translated to. I lucked into picking up a copy of Toriyama Sekien's Gazu Hyaki Yagyo like ages and ages ago.
Oh, okay.
There's no English translation for that, at least not the edition I have. And it's only in kanji, like primarily. Yeah. And because it's an academic look into it. So it's like 400 pages. And I was like, this is fantastic. If I could read it more than just like little bits here and there.
I recommend, and I found this actually researching this book too. Hiroko Yoda and Matt Ault did a translation. It's a little expensive, but it is so worth it. And they did. I would say Hiroko did a lot of the heavy lifting because she did. She took that ancient Japanese and translated it into English. And Sekien is so funny. He is hilarious. He's got lots of double entendres and just whatever naughty stuff in there. It's quite funny that you don't get it until you can read it. And she does a brilliant job and has the Japanese. And then on the other page would be the English. And she explains it. So if you could get your hands on that one.
I'll have to take a look. That's something I definitely would pick up. I have a few other editions that are just encyclopedia entries, and I'd like that's useful to a degree, but I'd like the annotated, like when you're digging into the academic version of stuff is more what I'm looking for usually. But I also can appreciate just like the sort of pop culture versions. And I think that that's an aspect of what you're doing with your book that really interested me was you'll have an entry on a yokai. And then something that we try to do with our show is you will take and have examples of here's current versions of that. And that's fantastic because just from like a general perspective, people may have more experience or can relate to like that current incarnation of this is a Pokemon version of it and then understand, oh, that's not just like a made up little critter that has some relevance with something historical. Like you can trace this back to something. And that's just really fun. That's more like the most interesting part, I think, just me. It's like I like the entries and I like to read everything, but it's like, oh no, I now I can go on a little quest and go look up these other references and just kind of broaden my knowledge on how these yokai and like what keeps them enduring and relevant.
That was the most what's it called, that was the part I was most insecure about. Like I was really afraid because I've lived here for so long, right? So I have no idea the culture, like the Western world, you know, be it Australia, North America, or Europe, you know, I have no idea what's popular or, and I'm not a big gamer, and manga and anime too, like just around me, right? Like my kid grew up and he was doing it and all this, so I was there, but I wasn't. With gaming, I knew when Nintendo 64, I think was it, came out like in 86 or whatever. I was in high school and my boyfriend's little brother had it and he was playing it all the time and I was playing it. And there was a moment of like clarity where I'm like, you know what? I could get very addicted to this thing and I could do nothing else for the rest of my life but like just play games. So I kind of like scared myself. Like I'm like, oh, okay, I'm an addictive personality. I could do this. So I've kind of like from a distance know about games and the same with anime and yokai. So I was very, very afraid that I wouldn't be able to catch all the references because they're everywhere. Yokai are in so many things. And again, the chapters weren't super long. So I'm like, oh, how can I fit everything in? But I do love that. I do love that you could take a Pokemon and go back and say, oh, it's from the 700s when, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
From this book, the Kojiki. I think it's so cool.
Yeah. And with that in particular, the Pokemon references, when those got localized to English, they're not always just a straight transliteration. It's like they made a different thing, and then you go back and read what it's called in Japanese. You're like, oh, well, this is a different thing. This is not how it's being represented outside of Japan.
Right. That's fascinating to me too. I do not envy the people that had to do those translations.
Yeah, well, that or just general localization teams and the effort that it takes to take something. And if you can't translate or if you don't understand the cultural references, but you have to it has to be something similar, but also understandable by the target language that you're putting it into. It's weird. It's like, that sounds a lot of fun, but at the same time, I don't really envy that particular job.
You'd almost have to be a bicultural, right? Yeah. Just know culture, both cultures so well to be able to, to bring that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So do you have a favorite yokai behavior since you've looked into all of these? And examples would be a kasha that falls from the sky to grab corpses, or the kappa when it bows and spills its bowl of water.
I love the kind of the quirky ones that for the first one, actually, when I was thinking about this too, the different yokai and what they do. And one of the first ones was when my son was little and there was a storm outside and it was thundering and lightning, and my mother-in-law quick, hide your belly button. And I was like, what? And she runs over to Julie and she's putting her hand over his belly button, lightning's going to come and take your belly button. And he's freaked out because he's never heard that. I've never said that to him because I have no idea. And she's very serious about it. And okay, wait, back up. What's going on here? And that's when I learned about, the god of thunder and storms and lightning. When you hear it, you have to hide your belly button because he likes to eat them and pluck them out. And it's just so horrible and so wonderful at the same time. It's just, and there's a story in the book that I found it a long time ago and then I refound it, and there's just a scene in the story where Raijin's going around and he's gnawing on a person's belly button. He's like, oh, he's just chewing on it as he's going about his daily task. And it's just so horrific and nonchalant that I just love stuff like that. What else? Ushioni with the literally cow demon, but it looks like a spider, is supposed to be so deadly. This one I thought was adorable because everything you read about it is like the most deadly and the most dangerous yokai out there. It's so terrible, it'll gobble you up whole and all this stuff, and that it looks kind of cute. It's not easy. It looks kind of adorable, this big spider with horns on it. And it will do something called kageoku, which is to eat or to lick your shadow. And it's so deadly that even licking your shadow will cause you to fall deathly ill and vomit blood. And just these over-the-top behaviors. I just love those. They really make me happy.
Terrified of having my belly button eaten now.
You cover it and you're good. Yeah, next time you hear thunder.
I'll keep that in mind. But of course, we've got lots of ancient traditional depictions of yokai, but there's also many more modern ones. You have a sort of a favorite modern depiction, whether that's anime, manga, or in film?
I think I'm gonna let myself get obsessed about something. I just did a show on Yomen Sukuna.
Yeah, I was listening to that.
I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't heard of this. This it could be very, very godly Buddhist creature, or it could be very evil. And so I was reading about it, and the more I was reading about it in English and in Japanese, it's called Jujutsu Kaisen. It's like a manga. It and the people who are into it are really into it, and they're talking about this what's his name, Egege Akutami. He's got a great name. It's Egege something. And so he's a Japanese the manga writer and artist.
He sounds
like a nut. I'm learning more about him too. I'm like, I could get into this, and I like his kind of take on it so far. I think there's going to be a trip to the bookstore for me in my near future, and I'm going to dive into that story and see how it goes.
Awesome.
But right now that's kind of in my radar.
Absolutely.
So yeah, Jujutsu Kaisen, that is one that is getting like international popularity. It's on most streaming services internationally. And it's pretty popular in the zeitgeist. There's a lot of fans, particularly in North America. I think I read a bit of the manga and I watched a couple episodes of the show.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's it reminded me a little bit of like something older, Yu Yu Hakusho.
It's
more of like a school focus, I guess.
It sounds like the school, the kids. Okay, we'll see what happens. But thank you. I'll see if I can find it somewhere. And I heard it was the anime was well done. It looked
It was pretty good. I enjoyed it. I was actually really interested listening to your episode because I didn't think whether or not whether Sukuna would be a purely fictional or a mythology based character, and now I know there's actual stories about him.
Me too. Like a lot of these things too. I'm like, oh, that's something this person made up, and I'm like, oh, nope, there it is. That's where he got it. Do you guys have anything you recommend? Because I would like to. Like, I'm at a point in my life finally where like there's a little bit of calm, and I kind of want to dive into something and just love it. And
trying to think. There's a couple of anime that have like some good yokai stuff. Try and remember. Mushishi. I like Mushishi.
Mushishi. Okay.
Yeah, there we
go. I get a lot of recommendations. I did, God, years and years ago, I saw the movie in Japanese. The problem with the movie in Japanese, I have one problem. I love the idea of Mushishi. I just love it. Mm. And Japan is an extreme, speaking of humidity, Japan is extremely humid and there are bugs everywhere. So... weird bugs too. So, I'm talking to someone from Australia. You know that.
Yeah, bugs, I know. Right? They weird bugs.
So, I love the idea of Mushishi. But in the movie, one of the characters, I think it was the girl, but she was really screechy. Like the whole thing, she screeched. And I have a thing with a sound. And I think it just kind of made it fall out of my skin. And I was like, oh, but I did pick up one manga and I really loved it. But yeah, I don't know why I stopped. I could go back into that. Thank you. Double recommendation.
It's not yokai centric, but it is urban legends, I guess, and old tales. It is the the name skips me once more. It's the old like shadow puppet theater, and I forget what that's called. But there's this show.
I should know too, and it's in my. It's like right on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah. It's on like I think it's like season 4. It's shadow puppet plays.
Neat.
Where the shadow puppet man who just he comes up and he calls kids over to like watch a little shadow puppet show. And each one is it's sort of like a anthology like Twilight Zone or Tales from the Dark Side. Where the little puppet think it's creepy. And you're not really watching the puppets. It just goes and he's just telling you a tale and he's narrating it. And so you get, they're like 5 minutes long each episode, real short.
What a brilliant idea.
Yeah. When I can remember the name of that show.
It's not Bunraku, is it?
Yeah. It's not Bunraku.
It's actually the shadows, not the,
It's not that. Cause the, Yamishibai.
Cool.
So there's 12 seasons that, and they're short little bite-sized things, but they're all it's just really fun. And a little spooky.
Yami is like evil. So that's cool. I've heard of it. Nice. Okay.
All right. Well, we'll roll back into the questions a little bit so we're not keeping everyone over too long. Okay, so with The Great Yokai War, Yokai Hyaku Monogatari, and Gegege no Kitaro, having remakes almost every decade, what do you think makes these depictions of yokai so enduring? Like, why does that keep getting remade?
I was The other day I was thinking about like my childhood and what kind of what supernatural or like whatever mythical creatures, and you know, you got a handful. There was not there weren't a lot. You have vampires and you've got what, fairies, werewolves,
yeah, like
dragons, yeah, maybe zombies more recently. And the thing that those creatures, the ones that come back again and again, I would say probably vampire would be the most, what, the most, you know, you've, from Bram Stoker to Twilight to Anne Rice, what else, True Blood. And I think what it is, thinking about it, it's the story of the creature. Like they're so rich and layered, and they're not two-dimensional, right? There's actually something there that you can grab onto and change from whatever generation to generation, from year to year. And with yokai, you've got hundreds of these colorful, weird, some are more shallow than others, but they're, and they all have different characteristics and personalities, and you've got the evil ones and you've got the goofy ones, and then you've got the more whatever mythic mysterious ones, and I think that is, and the playful, and you can, with each generation you can kind of reimagine or revisit them or put them in any combinations. It's just so rich. I just love that. And I think that's why. And I think there's so much more still to do with that.
Yeah. And so when I put that question together, I, of course, asked it to myself also, because that's not fair if I just put everything on someone else. But so in particular with say, Yokai Hyaku Monogatari, when that was remade more recently in the last 10 years or so, but 2009, I think, actually. Every time I always think that that's, oh, that was last year, right? No.
Right.
It was a little while ago. And what they've done is taken the yokai culture and use that as a lens to kind of look back at what's going on in just general society. And it's not always like a dark mirror. It can be constructive too. And the yokai themselves, they're given a little bit more characterization. Of course, there being so many of them, they have to pick like five of them. Here's five that we can, you know, spend some time on. But with that film in particular, there were using like mechanization and industry, and painting that as the actual like antagonistic bad thing that's happening. And then the yokai is, they're their own world, but that's still more of the natural than just an uncanny thing. And going, here's nature, here's the spirits that people are kind of ignoring these days because they're fading into some obscurity. But we'll make this resurgence, and hopefully that kind of putting it in the public eye, keeping it in the public consciousness, keeps these tales and traditions and things alive too. Particularly with Japan, at least up through 92, like leading the way technologically, like on the global stage. But it can't, you know, let go of its roots.
Pompoko did that too, right? That was very message, right, heavy. And Gegege no Kitoro did that a lot too. I can see that living here too, and especially like after the war and just how devastated, you know, Japan was, and that quick, that just incredible rebuilding. But what did they lose, you know? We've got a Toma, it's got Toma, it's like a highway that goes up and down Japan. It's the one, and they built a new one, and it's Daini Tome, so it's the second one. But you know, do we need it? It was such a big deal because it would have to go through mountains and all these nature and stuff, and I think Japanese are very, I mean, I guess any country would be, but to have that, have the yokai as a spirit, right, the kami, like everywhere there's kami, everyone believes kami, and they're kind of a kami, and you know, what are we doing? What are we doing to our land? I never thought of that, but you're right. I like that.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's the other kind of angle on it, where we have objects that if they're like 100 years old, they'll gain sentience. Mm-hmm. And I think that that plays into some of like the mascot culture where a city or prefecture will have its own like little animated mascot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like it's sort of an enshrined like local deity that is now like a little plushy guy.
Yeah. They're nuts. They are so everywhere and everything. Yeah. Our gas company has a mascot. The mail, every. Wow. If you have any kind of company, there is a mascot. And the funniest one is just recently, recently, it could have been 10 years ago for all I know. But the city, I used to live in Yaiza, it's kind of a fishing town, and I'm in Fuji, a little more inland, away from the tsunami that's bound to come. But the Fujieda one, Wisteria is the whatever, the city flower. And they made a mascot that is the most horrifying thing you've ever seen. It's like, imagine trying to make a Wisteria, like the drooping flowers, petal into a face, and it's tall, and it's creepy, and it's got purple robes. But everyone just adores it because it is just so weird. And the mascot culture. Sorry, I just went off.
But that already sounds like, we've made our own like yokai for the city.
Yeah. Or a little, give it another 100 years.
Exactly.
100 years. Yeah. I mean, with them still being very much sort of in the popular consciousness, you're kind of stuck around and they appear like they're not going anywhere soon. Do you think this sort of there's a sort of a change in the framing and the overall nature of yokai going on? Because I know like Jujutsu Kaisen, for example, really tends to paint them as, some of the yokai are like more sympathetic, but still obviously at odds with humanity and depicted as the quote unquote evil force in the narrative, whereas traditionally lots of yokai are just around. They're not necessarily good or evil. They're just, this is a spirit, this is what it does, this is where it lives, this is what you should know about it. Cover your belly button.
I kind of looking and doing the research for the book too, so Edo era, so what, 1603 to 1868, I think. So about that period of time was the golden age of yokai. And to me, although they go way back, like in the mythical beginnings of Japan, of course, they have all the mythical creatures and a lot of them turned into yokai. But if we're talking like just yokai, it seems to me like they were more almost a reaction to the environment or a way of dealing with the environment. So one of my favorite ones in that respect would be, so Japan blocked itself off from everyone. You know, there was the Sakoku, I forget what it is in English, where they said, we don't want to do trade or anything with anyone else for the most part, and no one could come into Japan. So it's this totally isolated island. And then when the black ships came and the ships started coming and foreigners like burst into, Matthew Perry just like, hey, let's open up Japan. They brought disease, and they brought diseases that had never been, they're not endemic to Japan, syphilis, typhoid, cholera, like all that, really terrible things. And the people didn't know what to make of these. So for cholera, you can't see it. Suddenly people are dropping dead and very sick. And they actually made a yokai called the korori. Sounds like cholera. So I'm thinking maybe someone had heard a foreigner say cholera and they put kanji to it. So it's like wolf, tiger, tanuki, I think are the kanji. It's three kanji for it. They invented this yokai. They gave it characteristics. It looks like a mishmash of a bunch of creatures, a tiger, wolf, tanuki. And if it attacks you, you die of the disease. So right now, yokai are fun and entertaining and can be good or evil or neutral or silly or whatever you want them to be. But almost back then, it was, a fear, like this is a real thing. Tengu Sarai, so the Tengu, the big long-nosed Tengu Sarai was a thing where Tengu would come in and sweep you away and take children and you'd never see him again for the most part. And I'm thinking, okay, children do get lost kids were abducted back then and they fall in rivers and they get, washed away. So, you got these parents like or this town trying to deal with this, and what had happened, and how do you deal with this? And well, a Tengu came in and swept him away, and I like almost a reaction to their environment. Although with the Tengu Sarai, which I found really interesting, is sometimes the people came back. they were like gone for years, and they would come back, and they're like, oh yeah. I was, you know, on the moon, and they describe it. And you're like, what? So it's kind of. I want to know more about that. That helps.
Yeah.
Answer.
Yeah. So yeah, they've always potentially been antagonistic, but it was a way of explaining and dealing. I mean, lots of folklore across the world is.
Exactly.
Yeah, I feel like the yokai sort of stand out to me just because they are often so much more detailed, and like you said, they're very, very rich and deep. There's just as many creatures in lots of Western mythologies, but they've not caught public consciousness in such a way. You know, you get the sort of big four, like fairies, werewolves, vampires, zombies. And then there's all these other ones. There's brownies and the little fae and stuff that aren't really paid attention to. But then you come to Japan, and it's like, well, what does this one do? Well, it falls out of the sky in a burning wheel of fire and steals your father's body from his funeral. stuff like that. It captures the imagination so much more in a lot of cases.
I wonder why that is. Do you think it would be like because of manga and anime and storytelling that
possibly, yeah. There's just sort of a dedicated base to keeping these stories alive and reinterpreting them for the modern audiences. But
I got an email from someone recently from Germany, a lovely lady, and she's like on some island now and everything, but she was telling me about some of the folklore from her area, and I'm like, this is brilliant, this is beautiful, I just love these stories. And same, yeah, I had never heard of them ever, but I'm sure you could go someone and say, hey, Tengu, or hey, Tanuki, and people would know that. So it's kind of interesting. You're right, I never really thought of that. That for some reason in Japan, they're much more worldly.
Yeah, they got the folklore out there, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, and it was in some aspects, that's part of the dealing with. We're going to collect a few different things that are a religion, quote unquote, because it's not Shinto and Buddhism and then Christianity. When things get all mixed up, you start like having to rationalize or explain a phenomenon to someone else that may not have all the like the cultural touchstones. And well, here we have a handy dandy illustrated ink book of guides, and that thing that you told me, I think that's this. And that's it's a nice shorthand to quickly get across information.
I like that too. Oh, okay. That makes sense.
The when you mentioned the Tengu that do the like the abductions. So there's a book I'd forgotten about it until you said that. The translation came out in 2009. It's called When Tengu Talk, and it's an ethnography of supernatural areas, and it's basically a supposed account of a child, now an adult, that had been abducted and came back, and he's like telling about the mountain he was at.
Yes. Oh, it's in English. There's actually an English
name. Hirata Atsutane.
Yes. And the
but
boy.
The translation is Wilburn Hansen.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know there was an English translation. Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
I was reading it in Japanese, and I was just like, holy crap, this is so cool. Like the Tengu made him fast for 100 days, and he couldn't do it the first time, so the Tengu tied him to a tree, and then he did it, and just crazy stuff. And he learned how to do martial arts or swords.
Oh, yes, and that was a big, and I imagine that could be a big draw for you in particular, is that ancient style of martial art that the Tengu are supposed to like. They can transfer that knowledge. That's why part of why a lot of movies and TV shows, and then just general like interest in martial arts, where you kind of go off to a mountain retreat or you go off by yourself into the wilderness to like hone your craft, because the other hope that I gather is that maybe a Tengu, you'll find someone that can be your master.
Right.
And teach you some secret techniques.
I was, one thing I learned when studying for this, I didn't know before, was that even now, there are mountains all over, of course, mountains all over Japan. It's 70% mountains, but there are still mountains dedicated to certain Tengu. They still believe that there are, I forget, it was an extraordinary number. This mountain belongs to this Tengu. And there is a prayer where, they list the names of the Tengu, the Nandoka Tengu goes to this mountain, and it's still said today. It's like a sutra or something.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I could see that. Like you're going off to Shugyo, I don't know in English, to hone your skills.
Yeah.
And you hope that Tengu favors you.
Yeah. It's so cool. All those little aspects, you could look at this holistically and find some aspect of it that I think that it can appeal to everyone. Maybe they've made them cute somehow, or maybe it's just a horrific story, or it's this packaged thing where, I'm gonna go on a pilgrimage and go visit all these mountains instead of the 100 shrine trip,
right? Right.
Yeah.
Which actually sounds great. So now I want to go do now I want to do that.
There you go. When's your next vacation?
Yeah. Okay, well, we've been at this for a minute, so I think we can probably get around to wrapping it up. I have one final question for you, and that is, what projects or topics are you looking into right now, and then can folks expect other books from you aside from your upcoming one?
Thank you. Let's see. So now I've always been my big thing is short stories. I by myself, I invented a genre called mythical realism. Not magical, mythical realism. And I just love writing short stories. But my agent keeps telling me we need a novel. Novels sell. Short story collections don't sell. And I'm like, yeah. That's 20 years. So I'm finally getting down to all these half-written novels and outlines to I've got to do it. I have to have the focus and the concentration to finish these. So currently I'm working on a middle grade. It's kind of adventure, weird, coming of age, yokai-ish. Fun. It's going to be really fun. So I'm hoping to get that done soon and then go to bigger novels and other things in the future. And I'm also very late to the game with visual novels.
Okay.
Oh my gosh. Is this the best way to tell a story or not? You have, you have sound design, you have music, you have some beautiful images that move, and the story splits up. So choose your own, right? Adventure, more or less. Just discovered those and am absolutely smitten. I like the storytelling. I like drawing. My partner is all things back end. Sound design is his thing. Plus, whatever do you program or RIMPI or whatever, he knows how to do all that. My son does great music. And I'm like, we are a team. We need to try this thing. So as a proof of concept, we're working on a short folklore, an old Japanese folktale. And about halfway done, we had to stop because I had to record the book and everything, but we're going to get back at it. And just see if it works, see what the reception is, put it out there for free, see if we can do it. If it fails, I'll do something else. But I just love trying different things and different ways to tell stories. So if it works, I have a great mashup of all these Japanese folk tales that I want to do in the future. So there's that when I get to it.
Well, that sounds great. Those are all fun things to look forward to for sure.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we'll wrap it up here. It was great to have you on the show.
It was so great being here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah. And maybe in the future we can have you on again, and we can look into a specific movie or something and just spend a little bit of time chatting about that.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. I love movies.
Yeah. So you have a few podcasts of your own. If you would like to tell folks where they can find those.
Uncanny Japan is the big one. That's the main one. I haven't done it in a while, but Soothing Stories is just telling in the public domain stories, kind of more of a people listen to my podcast and say, I fall asleep listening to your voice. It's so soothing. And I was like, I could do that too. So I haven't done one of those in a while, but it's still getting listened to. But Uncanny Japan is the big one. It's all Japanese kind of obscure-ish things, yokai, tales, whatever I feel like talking about.
Yeah, and when you record that one, that one's in binaural audio?
Try to as much as possible. Got some binaural mics and try to walk around and get like real, you know, if I'm talking about an ocean yokai or something, I'm a BA or something, I'll be at the ocean or whatever, rivers and mountains. So yeah, really try to get like you're here, like you're in Japan listening to me tell you a story about Japan is the idea for that one.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'll put links to those in the show notes. And yeah, again, it was fantastic to have you on. We would look forward to maybe having you pop on again for something else of your choosing. And I think for everyone else, that's good night. And we will catch you next time. The book comes out at the end of the month. So I will put links to that and folks can pre-order.
Thank you.
Monster Dear Monster is brought to you by Fireheart Media. If you enjoyed the show, please share this and all of our episodes with friends. And remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice. Word of mouth is the only way we grow. If you like, you can also kick us a few bucks to help us keep the lights on at ko-fi.com/Fireheart Media. Check out our other show, Jolichon's Place, at www.jolichon.place.